Hello and welcome to the GMBN podcast. This week we're joined by Joe McEwen, head honcho at Starling Cycles. So, do we want our bikes to homogenise or diverge from the norm? Are there any golden tickets available for bike design and material choice? Well, let's find out. So, going back to the beginning, born in the late 70s in... Whereabouts were you born?
I was born in Luton, actually, in Bedfordshire, yeah.
Cool, because you're based in Bristol.
Bristol, yeah.
Because what was bike riding for you like as a kid?
I actually grew up in a house, and we had some woodland opposite our house, so we just bombed around the woods on our bikes. But it was before mountain bikes, so it was on a BMX and on a racer, and just whatever bikes we had. But we were always, bombing around the woods.
In Bristol, hey?
Yeah.
So when did you move over?
So I came to Bristol for university in 95, and then I've been here ever since.
Oh, wow.
So I've been in Bristol ever
since. So you're pretty well settled in.
Yeah, I've spent more time in Bristol than I have in back home now. So yeah, that's quite
And in regards, you said you went to university, what did you study?
So I did a mechanical engineering degree.
Okay, cool. Is that the field you've always kind of worked in straight out of uni?
Yeah, so my first job was a company in Bristol doing aerospace stress analysis. So I've always done engineering. Yeah, it's always been. Yeah.
And was that for one of the big players?
No, it was for a tiny little company. They put up an advert on the notice board in the university, and I saw the advert for the job, and I thought, that's interesting. So I took the advert down, and bizarrely, I got the job.
So. Box in the box. Yeah. Like, that's good tactics for getting a job.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, coming from an aerospace sort of background.
Yeah.
Now, imagine, something like, we talk about engineering, but in aerospace, it must be so varied. Is there kind of subdivisions and fields?
Yeah, so there's lots of different fields. So you work on one specific area. So I was a static stress engineer, so dealing with the strength of components. But then you had fatigue engineers that dealt with loads under cycle, or sort of cyclic loads. And then you had materials and processes people, and you had aerodynamics people. So lots of different people doing lots of different things. And
because it's interesting, and it is, I don't think it's unfair to say, noteworthy. Aerospace engineer. And now your bikes are steel.
It's been noted.
It has. How did you, I mean, often we talk about types of frames and materials, and I worry sometimes that I come across as sort of disparaging, but it's actually just my sense of humour. Okay. I think with bikes, you get amazing alloy bikes, you get less so alloy bikes, same with carbon, same with steel. How did you settle on steel as a material to make your bikes out of?
So I suppose my aerospace background was predominantly in carbon fibre R&D. So I was developing sort of carbon fibre technologies and methods for analysis and new design. So I knew carbon fibre well, but the manufacture of carbon fibre in aerospace is so high tech, and the costs associated with aerospace carbon fibre manufacture are massive. So my perception is I want to make something like an aerospace component, but it's going to cost hundreds of thousands of pounds. So, and then I looked at the sort of carbon fiber bikes out there, and their quality wasn't anywhere near the aerospace quality. I should be careful what I say, but if you look at the sort of wrinkling in some of the components and even the carbon fiber bits I've chopped up, the quality is a bit, it's not aerospace quality. It's fit for purpose. So I'll be careful here. So it does the job on a bicycle, but it's not good for bikes. So
when we're looking at a steel frame, we can look at aluminium or metal frame. We can look at things, and people always say, uniform welds or double buttered. So there are lots of ways visually that even somebody is kind of uneducated to the demands of, fatigue testing and stuff like that, we can kind of understand. To the uninitiated, when you look at a carbon frame, what are the things to look for that would be...
Well, you can't see because it's internal.
So, even internal. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? What would be something that you saw internal or otherwise if you chopped a crank in half and you'd go, raised some eyebrows?
So it's there. Carbon fibre is made up of lots of layers in different directions, and you want those layers and the thickness between the layers to be as consistent as possible. When you've got a flat sheet, it's very easy done, but when you start forming complex curves, it doesn't necessarily curve the way it wants to. So you might end up with lots of fibre shoved in here and lots of resin down here. You end up with wrinkles, and all of these things sort of detract from the strength of the component.
So
you want it to look as smooth and as sensible as possible.
So in a way, it's actually not that dissimilar to welds, and that you want them uniform.
Same with anything. If it doesn't look right, it isn't right. So
when you put it like that.
It's really simple, really. It's just,
Because we have, I think, quite a peculiar sort of relationship with our bikes. I think because bikes are so, it's easy to see what's going on. It's all external.
Yeah.
It means that some things, some complicated jobs are very easy to do.
Yeah.
And some not so. Do you think that sort of maybe, how to put it, we kind of, as consumers, we pat ourselves on the back too much for our understanding of bikes. And then so suddenly we go, carbon, that's something I don't understand. So therefore it must be more complex. It must be more...
Carbon's just... It's carbon fibre, when used properly, is lightweight. It's very strong. It can be tough. Mm. You know, so it is a very good material when used properly. And that's why it's used in aeroplanes. That's why it's used in Formula One cars. So yes, it has a perception of a quality material. So if you've suddenly got a bike made out of carbon fibre, it's going to be a quality thing. But it's got to be made properly, hasn't it? Yeah. It's got to be made in the right way. So, but I think even a badly made carbon fibre bike is similar performance to, say, an aluminium bike.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Unless you whack it.
Yeah.
I personally think the reason they make carbon fibre bikes is there's a perception of quality. And it's unskilled labour. So to weld a frame well, takes somebody who is skilled. So you go to Taiwan and all the welders out there, they've been doing it for years and years and years. Mm-hmm. All the carbon fibre bikes are made in China. They're made in China because it's low pay and it's unskilled labour. Once you've paid for the tooling, all you've got to do is throw the carbon fibre into the tool, stick it in the autoclave.
Yeah, I mean, you know...
It's a bit controversial, that, but I think that's why the big companies do it.
You're entitled to your opinion on that and your reasoning. Mm. You know, for me, I don't have a team on this. Mm. Do you know what I mean? I'm really lucky to ride some just lovely bikes and I enjoy riding them tremendously.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But if somebody said... You know, for instance, my Mega is carbon, my new roof Mega, and I love riding it.
Yeah.
It is just, it's an absolute pleasure. If next year Nuke Proof said, we're only making aluminium bikes, I'd go, okay, cool. Yeah. They said making titanium. I'd go, I'll still really enjoy riding it.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Because there is a conversation, I think it's probably mainly, I mean, I think driven wouldn't be an unfair word. I think driven by someone such as Paul, where... They obviously, you know, is a very ultra progressive in some of their values. Mm-hmm. And they say about, and it's quite a contentious term, they say ocean fill when they talk about carbon frames.
Yeah.
Now, putting that to one side and saying, okay, cool, so there's sort of an understanding of perhaps the pitfalls of carbon production. Mm-hmm. When we look at something like titanium or aluminium, and it should be said here that Pol's bikes are glued, not welded. Mm-hmm. From that sort of environmental point of view, the gases used to stabilise, do you think they kind of balance each other out? Or
we started, before we were doing this, we were talking about environmental stuff. It is such a massive, complicated subject. Mm. And you've just got to be wary of companies saying they can recycle carbon fibre. You can't recycle carbon. What they do is they put it as filler in something else.
Okay.
But, you know, is me producing steel bikes more environmentally sound in Bristol? Maybe not, because I'm doing it on a small scale. Mm. You know, I'm not as efficient as big companies doing it.
So
although I'm doing stuff locally, it's the steel still comes from around the world. It's an incredibly complicated thing. And anybody who claims they are doing it in a more environmental way, it's just very difficult to prove. It's very difficult to understand.
And to be fair, that's probably quite a loaded and maybe unfair question, because I don't have the facts.
No,
really.
No,
I
nobody
have a
does.
Perception of the
no,
facts.
Nobody does until there was a worldwide kind of
audit.
Yes, basically. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, so I spent a little bit of time thinking about, where does my steel come from? So my steel comes from Reynolds. Reynolds actually buy tubes from Germany that they then butt and process. Mm. The tubes from Germany come from India and China. Mm. So my tubes have travelled the world already. So people think, oh, it's British steel. It's not British steel. It's some of it might come from Britain, but it would have gone to Germany first, where it's processed into the tubes.
It's interesting.
So it's really complicated.
I've got a friend, and this sounds, I'm going to go off on a tangent here, but
okay,
I will
bring it,
where they are a buyer for quite a big supermarket, and they try and ensure the quality and things like free range, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But everything is outsourced.
Yeah.
And so it's an absolute
nightmare. Yeah, probably comes from 100 suppliers. And,
Stuff like the textile industry has this problem. Yeah. Because they're basically like, our clothes are made in, good factory and people have good working conditions. But actually, it goes through so many. It's all quite difficult.
Yeah.
What do you, as a bike designer, how do you feel about standards? Something like Boost or whatever.
Oh.
Because for me, the example I would use is you don't get one car and get annoyed that you can't take the seats out and put it in another car or the wheels, Is that a fair comment, do you think?
That is, but one of the interesting things, most mountain bikers have got some kind of engineering background or sort of interest in engineering, and people like swapping bits around. It's what's fun about the sport.
Yes, you're totally right.
So I like that. And in the olden days, you would buy a frame and then you could fit different forks on it and you could swap all the bits over and get the bike you wanted and personalise your bike. And that was brilliant.
Mm.
Now, they change the standard, so we've got Boost, my wheels don't fit on my new frame, so I've got to buy a new wheel. So you end up getting to the point where it's more economic to buy a new bike. So I think that's the driver for standards.
Yeah, maybe.
But let's think, if you imagine it's a sport and it's fun, as a designer, I would like to have a set of boundaries. So imagine Formula One has limits. Each year they produce a rule book.
That's why
you then have to engineer within those limits.
Mm.
It's still an interesting sport. It's still an interesting engineering challenge. So,
I think you touched on something really cool.
Yeah.
Because the Formula One cars aren't as good as they could be.
No, but it doesn't matter. It's the sport.
But that, and I completely agree with that. And that's what I would like to see for racing. Mm. I would like to have a couple of series sponsors, i.e. a tyre sponsor. How good would it be if everyone was on the same tyres?
I don't know, because I think that's interesting, but let's all have tyres that all fit on the same rims and have some standard dimensions there, and let's have standard hubs, and let's have standard seat posts. So we've finally got a standard head tube, like tapered one. Yeah, it seems the steerers seems pretty consistent, and the headsets change a lot, but we can deal with that. But
with the tyre thing, I think the reason I would like to see it be a standardised across just a race series is because I think that there is such a huge, in my experience at least, variation in quality available.
Yeah.
And some people, they can have amazing riders.
Mm.
But if they're basically they're forced into a corner of having to take a big paycheck.
But then you put in a load of companies out of business which would be a bit.
No, that's fair. Maybe that's not that well rounded. But with our.
Quick aside, I was trying to start up a clunker race. So I wanted to do the rules are the bike is single speed, it's fixed, fully rigid, and they're the only bike rules, but you have standards like an inch and eighth headset, you have a threaded bot bracket, same seat tube. And let's start a race series with that. And the fast riders would still win.
It
would be exactly the same racing. And it would be really good fun. But then you would actually start a whole new, how do we build a bike within those boundaries? It would be really interesting.
Have you ever heard of the rule in Finnish grassroots rallying where you have to sell your car for €1,000?
So you can't destroy
spend
it.
More than €1,000
on it.
Because someone goes,
yeah.
If you could get a clunker and someone puts a box on it and someone says, well, I'll buy that for you for 500 quid, mate.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But it's the fun of the engineering. It's the fun of the sport. Technology, it allows us to ride more stuff, I suppose. So, you can ride stuff on an enduro bike that used to take a downhill bike. But I think now we've reached a point where they're pretty capable.
Hmm.
Let's tighten it up so that we get some interesting ideas, some more solutions.
But in regards to that, we were talking about with Formula One, the limitation being the formulaic engineering, which is great racing.
Hmm.
Do you think that because the consumers want to buy and can buy the bike that was just won in the World Cup Oval, then suddenly the fact they're not getting the best of the best and they're getting a limited bike, can you see there's a...
No, because the standards don't stop you still having a great bike. The standards is just fixing the...
Yeah, but I think if we took it to the extreme, something that's, sort of let evolve and happen, like the Formula One car, which has been doing formulas for years and years and years, then if someone was to buy it, they'd be like, maybe, do you see what I mean? They wouldn't want to be held by the limitations of the formula.
I don't think fixing standards so you can change parts detracts from still coming up with something amazing,
you've
still got loads of scope to change geometry and change suspension systems. It's just fixing the interfaces.
No,
that's the only thing you fix, isn't it?
But I guess the counter argument, and just to push you on this devil's avocado side, but you know, if they did that, say in, they decided in 2010,
mm-hmm.
this is when we're going to fix the standards.
Mm-hmm.
Our bikes, the consumer would be riding, would be very different today. Better, worse.
Is would you have more or less fun? And would racing be more or less fun?
I mean,
It just helps people with cost of things. Things are expensive, aren't they?
I think
they're a lot of money. And I think big brands changing stuff so you have to buy a whole new bike. People buy bikes on finance that they never used to. You know, there's all these things. It costs people money. And I just think that's a bit... It's making the sport a bit elitist, isn't it? It should be an inclusive sport. It shouldn't be an elitist sport. It should be just fun, isn't it?
Yeah.
We're here for fun.
Oh, are we?
Yeah.
Oh my God, I've been doing it wrong.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think that's very fair. I think especially when you see, you know, young rippers, and it's like, and you think, imagine, you know, if you had children, you had two kids that wanted to get into racing.
Yeah, you can afford it. Yeah.
Oh my God, it would be so hard. Do you think that maybe... almost mountain biking hasn't been around long enough or is changing so often that we don't get cheap bangers in the way that we could do with maybe motorbikes or something like that.
So yes, it's a new sport, so you've got to give it a chance to find where it is, but I think it's kind of found its feet now.
I think it has
so let's, you know, use this opportunity to think, right, let's stop it and think about why we're doing it. And
you have an idea. Maybe how did it start for you? You had a concept. How long did it take to get your first finished product, and has that time frame changed or increased or decreased now?
The first product was a standard hardtail, but when I started making full suspension bikes, it was doing it as a hobby. So it was in my shed making bikes for myself as a hobby. So the design iterated during that time, really, and I used to lie awake at night just thinking about little changes to make to my bikes and thinking about all the details. But I suppose I've had, for the sort of my main bikes, the Swoop and the Murmur, that design configuration has been around a few years now, and it works. And I've kind of, we make little small detail changes, but it's pretty solid. Mm. So in terms of designing new bikes, I've got a gearbox bike that I've got a prototype of. It came together pretty quickly, really. I can picture it so well in my head now that, yeah, it's relatively easy, you know. The thing about my bikes is they are simple, so there isn't anything complicated, and that's what I'm driving at, is keeping it simple. So coming up with a new design is a relatively easy thing, you know.
That's happened.
Yeah, it's not.
It's funny you say that about, you know, lying in bed and thinking about thoughts. Was there a great deal of time, or was it when you were still working full-time?
So I was quite lucky that I was working as a contractor, and the work I was doing was sort of tapering off, and my boss was quite happy for me to go home and build bikes when I wasn't needed. I was signing off calculation files and I was waiting for them to be produced. So I sort of had this really good period of about 6 months where I did aerospace less and less and less, and bikes more and more and more. And then I just got to the end and made the decision. Finished at Christmas one year, and that was it. Just finished, and then that was it.
And what was the moment like riding your first bike? Was that special, or was it like
the first
too,
bike?
Too much physical.
The first bike I made on the course, which was a hardtail, and it had the wrong head angle on it. It was Dave Yates, who's a bit of an old school frame builder. He convinced me a 72 head angle was right.
Oh, sounds about right.
It was awful. So I think I rode it about twice and then took it home and chopped the head tube off. And that's what started me making bikes. I could do this in the shed now. But the bikes that were the mountain bike, the sort of full suspension bikes, the first time you ride them, it's amazing because you think, oh, it actually works. And then the sort of more you ride it, oh, it actually works quite well. What have I done here? And it's really exciting. And it's, I think at the beginning, I'd ride a bike and about 2 months later, I'd have the next one because you'd straight away think, this is good, but yes, I just need to change this. And it happened. And I tried things like really low bottom brackets and really slack head angles. And, you know, went through all this iteration of trying different designs and getting the feedback.
But that's
really
so valuable, I imagine.
Yeah.
Something I've noticed with the Murmur, and we were talking about it just before on how the Murmur is a very progressive bike, I think it would be fair to say.
Yeah.
The angles in terms of, you know, the reach and the numbers.
It was. Now everyone's copying it.
But it's
everyone's coming to the same conclusions,
sort of,
let's
moving
say.
Moving that way.
Yeah.
You know, it's got, I think it's a really interesting amalgamation of what would be people's perceived idea of very forward thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean this as, you know, in a sort of an unfair way. But there are some people that would look at a bike and think steel is now sort of an old
application technology.
Single pivot is something that we've kind of grown out of now.
Yeah.
So it's a really interesting sort of setup of the cutting edge and also ideas that perhaps were visited a little while ago.
Yeah, I've always ridden single pivots and I've always liked how they ride. It's just, we talked before about what makes a great bike, I think, is that the rider can understand it. You control the bike, you make the bike go fast, so you need to understand it. A single pivot has always made sense to me. The way it behaves is just really easy to understand. So I've always got on well with single pivots.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a few linkage bikes and just didn't like them, and they was fell apart and things went wrong on them. So I was always going to design a single pivot. That was always going to happen. And I think as shock technology has progressed, I don't think shock technology has progressed, but you know, think of a coil shock, they're still just shim stacks. But I think the way we apply those shim stacks has changed, and I think
I would agree
the shocks perform better for bicycles now than they ever used to. I think maybe just the understanding. I just think the shocks work better. Single pivot works really well. It's you could argue it gives you a linear leverage ratio, but I think a linear leverage ratio is actually a good solution. I'm
probably quite, how to put it, I go against the grain here, and I think that a lot of time people talk about progressive.
Yeah.
I think actually, you know, you see bikes with a regressive leverage curves, and they have to put a progressive shock on there. And I think personally, I quite like things that are linear.
Again, it goes back to you understand it. If the shock doesn't do anything sensible, anything stupid, your brain can understand it. You ride well. Suspension tuners love a linear leverage curve because they can tune the shock really easily.
Yes,
if you have a shock curve that goes like this, they're going, you can deal with the first bit, but then how do we deal with the second bit?
Yeah.
And they have to do weird things. There's a compromise in the shock. Whereas a linear curve, they can deal with it. The only thing it might be an issue is if you're somebody who's hitting massive jumps and you don't want it to bottom out harshly. But one of the things a steel bike gives you, because there's a bit of compliance in the bike, you don't get a harsh bottom out. You know, you reach the bottom of the travel and the stays bend a bit. So it's got a bit of natural bottom out capability in the frame. So keep it simple. And then you'll understand it, you'll ride well.
Because there's a lot of, you know, you're saying about shocks getting better. I think that shocks definitely, I think even
air shock technology has changed a lot. They've learned a lot with air shocks. But coil shocks, the technology hasn't really changed. They might have added a sort of hydraulic bump stop or something. But it's still a shim stack. It's just how they apply it. But
I think, you know,
somebody will correct me on that, but I think I'm right.
We're talking about empirical evidence is sometimes the best. You know, I find with the bikes that, and it wouldn't be for me to say, I'm definitely not a good enough rider to talk about which bike's fastest, and also that never really is my concern when I'm riding a bike. Actually, it's what makes me smile or makes me happy. Is that something, it must be, when you've got a large company or a big design team, it must be very easy to extract ideas and differing opinion and sort of, you know, diametrically come to our ideas. With yourself, how do you think, I have a vision and I'm going to pursue it? Or do you kind of give yourself a hard time and go, actually, what would the opposite of this be?
I suppose, the design has been a lot for myself. But I never thought of that question. It's a quite interesting one. But I've had feedback from riders.
If you want
to
give you a hard time on a Sunday morning, I can just turn up.
The design, because I'm trying to design something simple, it's an easier design process, I suppose. It's just trying to simplify. So it's almost easier to have a simple design coming from a single mind. You're never going to get a simple design from multiple minds, are you?
Yes.
Because you're going to get a conflict of ideas. But in terms of getting the performance right, I've always had feedback. I've always had, you know, team riders, I've had other people riding bikes. Because I've made custom frames, I've had a lot of direct feedback from my customers. So I could probably name every customer almost. I hear their names. Oh, yeah, I made you that one. Yeah. I can remember details. So I've had all that feedback from them as well. So it's you could say it's perhaps a cloud source design.
Oh, so, wow.
That sounds good, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does sound good.
You know, it's my seed of an idea and my thing, but it has been informed by lots of other people's.
And I know at one point, I don't know if it's still the case, are you still offering custom sizing?
I'm about to kind of stop. So right, okay. We talked about this briefly. I'm bringing production of the front triangles back to the UK. So I'm going to be doing Taiwanese swing arms with UK front triangles. And sort of temporarily, or sort of for sort of next few months, we're only going to be doing standard size UK frames. But down the line, I will go back to doing custom because it's something I can do. But it's just we need to get the processes in the workshop sort of. Yeah, we just want to concentrate on standard for the time being, and then we'll go back to the custom ones.
Yeah. Because how, from your point of view, as somebody that's, creating something that is obviously so important, the frame, the heart of our bikes, how subjective do you think bike setup is? Because I would say that if it's, like, take tyre pressure, for instance, it sits within an operational band. Mm-hmm. Of that's how you get good. Mm-hmm. But then every now and then you come across someone that goes, well, I run 45 PSI. Mm-hmm. But it's actually subjective. Yeah. You're like, I mean, it is.
It goes back to how it's a rider-operated vehicle, isn't it? It only goes as quick as the rider. So if they like 45 PSI, then...
But if somebody said to you, on a 60-degree head angle, would you try and educate them, or would you go like...
I do, because I've had a few people who have asked for really slack head angles, and they've been less happy with their bikes. I think the geometry as it is works pretty well. You can add or take away a little bit, but if you go too far, it doesn't ride as well. It starts affecting it. So I get a lot of people, I want a 60 degree head angle because they think that's right. And I have to sort of rein them back in. Yeah. So yes, yeah. I will advise people to go the right way. And I think if you go too far, it does go wrong.
Yeah.
But
what if they said, listen, I've done the research. And they would we ever just go, you know what?
I have built bikes out for people.
Because I'd love to put my money where my mouth is and find out if I actually know what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
that sounds like I've got a lot to lose. I'm in quite a happy delusion here that I kind of sort of do.
But I've been through all these things as well. Like I said, when I was first doing the sort of early prototypes, I tried a 62 head angle and I tried a very low bottom bracket, and I tried like really short stays and really long stays. So I've tried all these things, and what I've ended up with is, I feel, the most balanced bike. And it's this simplicity in balance as well. Balance is really important. If you start raking the front out, it just moves the weight a bit, and it doesn't ride as well. So
yeah, I mean, you know, when I did my coaching course, they talked a lot about the differences between balance and stability. Balance is something, is a point.
Yeah.
Stability is resistance of external forces. Mm. And I think sometimes, you know, and I love riding long and low bikes.
Mm.
And they do, I think, resist forces. Mm. When you're going fast,
they resist forces to the nth degree, super stable. Yeah, yeah.
With things like, for instance, ultra long, the extreme, super long stays, you know, reduced offset forks. How do you kind of make your mind up? Do you think, actually, this is where I like to ride my bikes? I ride them on a great varied terrain. But, you know, the enduro bike now has become so capable. And so it has the ability to almost struggle under the weight of how much it can do.
I pretty much make bikes for how I ride and what I ride. So,
but at least that's consistent.
Yeah.
At least that's a line in the sand.
No, people say to me, can you make a gravel bike? And I'm not going to make a gravel bike.
You just bump up the tires, don't you?
I'm never going to ride a gravel bike.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to make I made a downhill bike, and admittedly, I haven't been a downhill bike for about 5 years, but I always used to ride downhill, and I always wanted a single speed downhill bike.
Mm-hmm.
That was my dream for years. So I made one because that's what I always wanted.
Would I be right in saying that I saw that at the Bespoke?
Yeah. Show? Yeah.
How, Bristol seems to have a really good scene for that.
Yeah.
How do you think that you would have landed on this idea of starting your own bike company had you not been living in Bristol?
No, I think it's part of me. I always make the things I did. So I skateboarded when I was a kid, and I've made a skateboard, a pretty rubbish one, but I made a skateboard. I uh, did radio controlled cars for a while, and I actually made my own chassis and own little bits for it. I was a golfer for a long time. I was quite a good golfer. Oh, nice. Yeah. I made a golf club even.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, my word.
Out of some plywood. I made a wood and sort of out of some plywood and fiberglass and some inserts and stuff. Yeah. And I think it fell apart, but it's inherent in me for what I'm doing to make it. So ever since I've been mountain biking, I've always modified the bikes I've had. I've always run longer shocks or changed shock mounts, or I had a single speed orange downhill bike for years. You know, I've always fiddled with things to get them how I want. So I was always gonna, it's irrelevant at Bristol. Bristol's a great place, and it's perhaps made turning into a company easier, that I've been close to people like yourself and originally and MBUK even, you know. Am I allowed to say other brand? Other media outfits, but they're wild. They're all local to Bristol. But you know, they're local to Bristol, and I've had a bit of help from Chris Porter. He's been useful,
of course.
And,
yeah.
There is a certain swell of people around. You know, even now, our industrial unit, our unit where we make the bikes, next door we've got our wheel builders, so that's quite nice. Yeah. We sort of work with that, and yeah, I know all the sort of bike companies and sort of shops in Bristol quite well. And
it's good. Community does help, I suppose.
Yeah.
Because where did that come from then?
I'd say my brothers are all, they're all in the building trade, so they've always made stuff. And I don't know. Yeah, my mum's very creative. She's very good at making stuff. I think it's just the way I am. Probably lots of influences, but.
Because what's next for Styling Cycles? You mentioned a gearbox.
Yeah.
Is there an element of, would it be fair to say, keeping up with the Joneses? Do you look over your shoulder or do you just go, gearbox is cool? Because it's now, in the last 2 weeks, been such an interesting development with the Shimano thing.
Yeah.
Everyone's just, gearbox!
Yeah.
Man the stations!
people have wanted a gearbox for years. A derailleur is a silly system for off-road riding. I ride a single speed a lot of the time. The bike I ride the most is a single speed. Mm-hmm. Because
your gear cable's corroded.
Well, no, I just find it works better, and it doesn't go wrong. If you can get up the hills, it's fine. It's good fun. I wouldn't have one if I lived in big hills, but Bristol, single speed is perfect.
Yeah.
And
is that on a full suspension bike?
Yeah, it is. Beady Little Eye, look it up. It's really good. A short travel, it's a 90mm travel, full sus, single speed. Amazing. Best, most fun in the world.
Yeah, it's so much fun.
But so the gearbox bike is something I've thought about again for years, and I've been chatting to Effa Gear for a few years now. Mm-hmm. We made a prototype about 18 months ago, but its development's a bit slower than I hoped. Because I'm busy, really. I haven't got a lot of time left for doing development. I'm doing a lot of just getting our production sorted in the UK is the main focus at the moment. But we've got this project going with Autodesk going on.
You talk about 3D printing,
yeah,
but this isn't 3D printing. No. This is something very similar to. But could you just explain Autodesk a bit?
Yeah,
for somebody, if I can understand it, then I think our viewers will be able to, because that's the level of perception about.
Autodesk they make AutoCAD, the sort of CAD software, but they've also got a lot of their company devoted to clever computer systems for designing stuff and manufacturing stuff. So they've got this thing called generative design, where you essentially grow the structure. So you put in all your boundary conditions for a particular case, press go, and it comes back and designs your structure for you and puts all the material where it needs to go. So I've been working with them to help them develop a new bit of software to come up with a part that replaces the front portion of my swing arm with an aluminium part, which isn't steel, but it does the job. Yeah. And it's a little bit lighter, it's easier to manufacture. It's just looking at the next step of changing the bike a little bit. And it's just a really interesting project. Again, coming from R&D, I like doing this stuff. It's really interesting. And it actually started off with me supporting a Bristol student, Ben Boxer, and he was helping me out on some stuff. And then he got involved with Autodesk, and then I sort of piggybacked on with it.
It's just really interesting. It sounds very, very, very interesting. We've talked a lot about, we would like to get a 3D printer here. Because one of the cool things about it would be, in our tech shows, we talk a lot about, people always say, I made this, but we could say, send us.
We can almost make a bank of
GMBN tech things, and someone on the show could go, that's pretty cool. And then they can make it at home.
Yeah.
And so it would just be like a really nice sort of community community feel, although...
But this software isn't 3D printing. Sorry. It's using 2.5D CNC. So the idea is to make it... So 2.5D is basically it just goes up and down like this.
Oh,
it doesn't do any clever machining. So it's really manufacturing driven.
Right, okay.
And you gain a bit of performance. But that, instead of 3D printing, that costs huge amounts of money. So we did a 3D printed part and it was going to be like £1,000 for the 3D printed part. And it looked amazing. It was all these organic shapes. It was really interesting. But that's not economical. I can't sell... Oh, here's an extra £2,000 to have a... somebody might buy it, but it's not sensible. Whereas the 2.5D machine bit is nearly the same performance, but in a part that can be machined more easily. So it's just really interesting. And it's I think the 3D printing is kind of the sort of flagship of that's what it... But in reality, software and clever engineering software like that can do so much more. It just doesn't look as exciting, I suppose. So that's why it's never shown in the media. But you know, we'll see more and more of that structure that's designed by computers, and which is it's interesting.
It's very interesting, and I'm super. We were just talking before we started recording about maybe coming and having a look at some of the things that can get out, which would be awesome. And I'm also really excited to see, where this happens with the gearbox.
Mm.
So some interesting and stuff in line with Starling Cycles.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming on, Joe.
Okay. Yeah, no worries.
It's been great. As always, you can listen to this on Spotify or any of your podcast listening services of choice. Thank you very much, and we will see you next time.